What's the Netflix movie White Noise all about, and did we like it? A lot of us liked Bardo, also on Netflix, but how much and why? Those things and more on this week's episode of Taking It Down.
An elevator tape projection.
I'm Blaine Duncan. I'm one of the hosts of Taking It Down. Taking It Down exists because if I was alone, I'd still want to know why I like what I like and what I dislike when it comes to TV, movies, books, and music. I have an English degree and a teacher's mind, so I try to offer up my best insight worthy of time. And I was once your classic kid who grew up in front of a television set and was thrilled to visit the movie theater. All of that combined might produce some interesting thoughts, but my ideas aren't the only set of viewpoints here, as with me every week is Adam Morrow, who's an erudite traveling musician with a penchant for literature. We've got Donovan Reinwald, a media specialist with encyclopedic knowledge on film and more, and Natalie Morrow, who's the first person to ask about fantasy, sci-fi, comics, trashy reality TV, Beyonce's music, and even more than that. From us, you get obvious and obscure. Join us every week on Tuesday. But here they are, the co-host and their hellos first. If you need leaf mulch, leaf compost.
Mold. Leaf mold.
Mold. Fine. Leaf mold. Mulch mode.
We will use the mold as a mulch. How about that?
That was close. It's Adam Morrow. There he is. If you haven't visited your public library lately, this is the guy who's going to tell you why that you need to do that. It's Donovan Reinwald.
Libraries are great, Blaine.
No, Natalie, this week I visited my public library. This episode's all about your public library. No, it's...
You want to talk the public library?
I loved it.
Because... I vote. My taxes are going up because I voted for a public library expansion. Gosh darn it, the place they have right now doesn't have good parking. It should be more accessible to more people.
Let me ask you guys something. When's the last time you went in a public library and left thinking, well, I'm in a worse mood now?
Probably never.
Never, right?
I used to, so I'm in Manchester, Connecticut now, which has a kind of nice, more old-fashioned library, early 20th century. But I used to go, my public library used to be the Wyndham Center Public Library, which was originally a bank building from the 1830s.
Whoa.
And the library was basically all one big room. And they had, the librarians were very, they had what they had. It wasn't very big. But the librarians were great. They were like, we'll get you anything you want on interlibrary loan. And they had stuff like a letter from George Washington up on the wall.
I didn't know he was still alive.
A figure of Bacchus sitting on a wine barrel that some British POWs have carved during the Revolution. Just all kinds of cool stuff.
Man.
It was amazing.
And how far are you from Wyndham these days?
So I'm about 35 minutes away.
About an hour and a half. All right.
You know, the good thing about interlibrary loan in New England is they can just throw the books from one town to another. So it doesn't take long at all.
This is actually kind of cool. If in Connecticut, if you get like your public library card, wherever you go, works at any other public library.
That's pretty cool.
That is cool.
So Donovan, yeah, when you apply to be a librarian in Connecticut, do they take you to the football field and give you a ball? And if you can zing it, I don't know, 35, 40 yards, you get the job?
Oh, I thought you'd be done. You didn't get the job.
Yeah.
You don't have to throw it far to get it to the next town, from what I understand.
We're looking for the opposite skills. You know, someone who is just terrible at sports.
If it doesn't go 5 yards, yeah.
You know, libraries do segue quite well into one of our real conversations we planned on having, which is about White Noise. First of all, it's based on a book. Second of all, it's based on a professor.
Do you know the Hold Steady song where the chorus is, when they kiss, they spit white noise? White noise.
No, I don't know that. I'm
That's
not
all
a
I
big
can think
hold,
of.
Not a big Hold Steady
guy. Oh, really?
Guy.
Yeah. Okay. All I could think, I was like, they're really missing out on an opportunity by not using this song.
Well, they did rope in LCD Sound System, which seems to be more hyped than the movie in some circles.
Well, and they had one of the greatest musical guest appearances in film history.
Which we'll get to. We don't want to spoil anything off the bat. White Noise is a Netflix movie about a lot of things, really, but mainly a professor whose family goes through a toxic airborne event. And then what happens after that, I suppose. It's directed by Noah Baumbach and stars Adam Driver, Greta Gerwig, and Don Cheadle. And if you don't already know, it's based on a novel of the same name published in 1985 by Don DeLillo, a famous author. And I think we chatted just a little beforehand. None of us have read the Don DeLillo work.
Right.
And after watching this movie, I wish I had.
Right. Yes. But at the same time, you do get the idea of what some critics were talking about when they said, compared it to the novel.
I would like to read the novel, especially because apparently it's famously unfilmable.
That's
yet
the thing.
It got filmed.
Yeah.
And I'd like to know why.
Me too. Because I'm okay with the movie. I think mm-hmm. I liked it a lot more than critics and a lot more than some fans I see online. I judged it for the film that it was, and I ended up at the end of it thinking, I get it. I saw what it wanted to do, and I was appreciative of that. So hard to talk about this one, I think, without spoiling it, maybe a little. So we'll just spoil it right here, right now. If you haven't seen it, it has some moments that I suppose could be spoiled for you. It's got some plot points in it. It feels like, so that's where I was going. It feels like it's fine to think of as a film. It was easy for me to lay aside that it was a book first.
Sure.
You know, but I did start the conversation saying that it's easy also to see how it was a book and maybe...
But you're just kind of taking it as its own entity.
Exactly. DeLillo and Baumbach say their themes. They're deliberate with their big ideas that they're trying to get you to digest. And it's as best I can tell, it's as if they're both saying, we're going to examine this idea of death and our avoidance of it through these characters, and you can come along with us. Especially Baumbach, I guess I could speak to.
That and a serious threat of satirizing academia, which having worked at a university library, I really appreciated.
That was blatant at times.
Yeah.
I'd be interested to know, to dig deeper onto the unfilmable part of it. And I wonder if that's because it's a, I mean, not that odd films are a new thing, but maybe they're, because of streaming, because of the internet in general, people have a bigger appetite for, you know, this movie felt like three separate kind of contained storylines. And I can see at a point, maybe in the 80s or 90s, people just thought, well, anything that's not a A to B to mm-hmm. C kind of conventional screenplay, then, you know, that's not something that most people would be into. To me, I didn't love the movie, I'll be honest. And I didn't, there were aspects of it that I enjoyed. I'm a Baumbach fan. I like Greta Gerwig a lot as well. I think Adam Driver's very hit or miss for me. I guess we can get into parsing all that out as we go. But just broad strokes, it seemed to be aware that it's an unfilmable story in like a, it's trying a little too hard for me. Does that make sense?
I think it does.
First of all, I'll speak for Adam Driver and say that you should not hold the character of Kylo Ren against him. He did not write that shit, okay?
He didn't, but here's an interesting thing to me that, and I'll rope Natalie in by proxy here since she can't be here today. We talked about the fact that they really aged up Adam Driver and Greta Gerwig in this. Mm-hmm. Both of them are right, like north of 35, still south of 40. So it's kind of like they can play young or play older. And playing them older was just an odd decision. Like, they didn't, to me, have the gravity of if you'd picked a different set of actors to do that. And I know that trio, that director, and obviously Greta Gerwig is involved in a lot of his work, but they've worked a lot together, and, you know, I had forgotten that Adam Driver's even in Francis Ha, so he's been around a long time, but it didn't quite scratch the itch. I was aware that they were trying to do something the whole time. And maybe that was purposeful, you know? I don't know. I know it's supposed to feel unsettled the whole time, and both their interpersonal relationships and the veneer of the town and, you know, the weird stuff with, like, the grocery store and kind of them dipping out of in and out of different motifs, and like, he's a Hitler scholar, what does that mean? Are we in some sort of alternate history thing where Americans revere Hitler? Well, I guess we kind of are in some pockets now, but more broadly, as is often the case when I talk to you guys, maybe I'm slowly talking myself into thinking that it was a better performance than I initially found it to be.
I think you really put the finger on it when you said, I could always tell it was trying to do something.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I think Noah Baumbach is, with his sensibilities, almost the poor man's Wes Anderson.
Yes. Yep.
But with Wes Anderson, it he somehow, I mean, and there's sometimes, like I'd say in the French Dispatch or something like that, there's moments where you can say, oh, he's trying something. But I think he makes it more effortless than Baumbach.
Absolutely.
Even kind of clubs you over the head with it.
Even in his bombastic moments, like French Dispatch, like, one, the people that he works with are so good. And, you know, chicken, egg kind of thing of the level of talent that he's able to attract and keep. But, yeah, just the softer touch, the across the Anderson filmography, there's so many moments that hit. The shtick is put aside and genuine emotional moments happen. And I don't remember a lot of that happening in Baumbach. I mean, I enjoy his films, but it does feel just like a, you know, the meme of, well, I want Wes Anderson. It's like, well, we have Wes Anderson at home kind of thing.
The characters just, they acted like characters in a movie. Like, no one spoke with natural cadences. It, you know, you take the Don Cheadle and Adam Driver scene in the university room where there's no way in hell that would happen in reality. The stilted performances and stilted way of presenting it is a genuine statement. Like, it's saying, it's using fiction to examine the real on purpose. As if to say the real is almost too real. The real is almost too real, and we don't want to look at the real. You know what I mean?
That reminded me of all things, a lot of David Lynch movies, where his characters and, or even like season three of Twin Peaks, it's deliberately stilted. And I think you hit on probably the reason he does it, which is that these things are too fast and urgent to face head on.
Yeah.
So we can only dance our way around them.
I think the difference, I mean, even the original run of Twin Peaks is obviously camp. You know, there's camp moments. There's moments where he just tries to lean into weird Americana or whatever it is in between the, you know, it's funny. That's sometimes when I recommend Twin Peaks to somebody, and then especially if I sit in on a few episodes as they're watching, it's like you forget that these giant ideas that he presents so beautifully are sandwiched between moments of pure ridiculousness, which is kind of the beauty of it. But just I was so hyper aware that Adam Driver was acting the whole time, in a way that even when it's over the top, it doesn't happen in a Twin Peaks or any kind of other work where that's where the point is that it's overdone. Like, I see that, Blaine, what you said, especially about the university scene. I didn't have that problem with Don Cheadle at all. I really just had it mostly with Adam Driver and some with Greta Gerwig. Though I have a soft spot for her for some reason, so I she gets more of a more leeway, I guess, before criticism.
I noticed when they were talking to each other, the Adam Driver character and the Greta Gerwig character, that was often when, and I don't know if this is a scripting thing or a directing thing or what, but it sounded the most artificial.
Yeah.
Like they were just reading lines.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Again, we're talking about it more, and it makes it seem more planned and well-executed and all these things to a larger point. But, you know, even the reveal in the script or the arc of the story or whatever, that, you know, they're laying in bed and talking about, I want to die first. No, I want to die first, all that kind of stuff. And then you figure out that this isn't like this house full of kids in the suburbs that looks so nice. These are like from collectively like six different marriages, right? that they've been involved in. It has a little bit of the don't worry, darling kind of let's present a picture and then pull it apart kind of thing.
Yeah. To me, it felt like it was saying that the avoidance of existential dread is in itself stilted and unreasonable and unreal and shallow and too television-like. And once I accepted that this movie is the way it is, and maybe the novel is too, I really liked it. I liked how Baumbach was not trying to be very vague. He was not trying to be vague about any of his big ideas, but he was given enough wiggle room that you could kind of interpret it as well. He's kind of punching you in the face, but also giving you enough room to dodge if you wanted. So I think I liked it a lot.
It wasn't subtle.
no subtlety, but it also gave me a lot to think about. And it gave me thoughts that I'm not sure every viewer would have.
And sometimes I think one of the places this did succeed, which we haven't touched on, is that occasionally, more than occasionally, it was very funny. Like there's the bit where they're trapped in the car going down the river. And I thought I really like Adam Driver. So his performance there of like just the completely overwhelmed dad, and the kids ask him, "What if there's a waterfall, Dad? Is there a waterfall?"
Yeah,
and he just has no idea what to do. I thought that was great. Well, like there were moments of surreal humor that I thought he really pulled off well.
He played physical humor pretty well too in that moment, and in the moment where he's trying to get on the roof. I thought both of those were good. I like Adam Driver. Maybe it's that I want him to hit marks that his director is not wanting him to hit and everything. Because it's like, we had the conversation when it was over. It's like, who is in that age range that is poised to like take over being the superstar, you know, that you think back on the household names of... Who's Brad Pitt? Who's George Clooney? Who's Leonardo DiCaprio? And there's like a pretty big vacuum there, it seems like. And people want him to step into that kind of superstar role, it seems like. But I don't know. Maybe I'm way off base there.
I kind of appreciate that his inclinations are really like, I'd rather do the weirder, smaller movie.
Yeah, totally.
Like I'm already cashing my Star Wars checks.
Right.
Like I'm fine.
I appreciate that. And I mean, his whole arc of, I mean, could we pretty comfortably say that Girls was his launching point?
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, maybe it's because it's there and I will forever think of Girls as like so tied, Donovan, to you and me, our very specific sliver of a generation, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I want our guy to make good.
Want him to thrive.
Yeah.
The answer, of course, to who's the next Brad Pitt is Jesse Plemons.
Duh. Glad you said it.
That's completely unfair to name three just like unfathomably successful people and, you know, that have done a lot of pop movies. And obviously this next generation is maybe not as interested in that. I don't know. I just thought of people who are super famous who still do an odd film now and again, and how they would have played that role.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I found that he came up a little bit short. But
Interesting.
Blaine, I think you make excellent points, Blaine. So I think it's I may have been a little harsh in my viewing.
I think both are fair. I think you could say that about Driver and Gerwig a little. But at the same time, you could come back around and say, well, maybe that's the point. It's supposed to be so stiff that it's supposed to feel like artifice, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, that just felt like, especially with the grocery store and the university stuff,
yeah.
None of it felt, it all felt like they filmed it on the set of Stranger Things, but also put a tag at the bottom that said, on the set of Stranger Things in Atlanta.
Yeah.
You know, the only moment I didn't find like that, the moment of kind of real emotion was, I think this is a testament to her skill, was Greta Gerwig, kind of long confession of what she'd done, of her
cheating,
quote unquote, indiscretion.
Yeah.
And it's not artificial. And I thought she did a really great job of striking like a real emotional core that maybe the rest of the movie doesn't quite take up. Like the Adam Driver's character's reaction to it is a little, it is back into the artifice.
It is. If we're thinking, Natalie would dog us for this because I like to think of what's presented as purposeful. If I trust my director, if I trust my actor and my writer, I have to think that what they've given me is done on purpose or they were cut short of time. Either one. You know, I just think that maybe Adam Driver is supposed to be fake somehow or another, not real. And Adam,
I mean, he's a professor of Hitler studies, right?
Like exactly.
it's a made up thing already there.
Who doesn't speak German, by the way?
Right. I was going to say he's already a figure of ridicule because he can't speak German.
Well, and even you're talking about the cheating third act, I guess we could call it. Even like the gun that's used there is kind of like it's not a plastic gun, but it's also like you can shoot somebody more than once and they're fine. Ish. You know, like the stakes are padded a bit, I guess.
Yeah. together. It's odd. And a lot of times when I watch a film and I know that we are going to talk about it, I'll predict what you guys will be thinking. And when I finish it, I'll think. And I really thought Adam was going to come in and say that he liked it because of its existentialism.
No, I'm saving that for the second part of our podcast.
Well, there's plenty to go around.
Well, and I think it probably didn't do this a good service that I watched them in close succession. And spoiler alert for my broad strokes in the part two of this podcast, Bardo is very much my shit. So this one was maybe not as much.
I also watched them 2 days in a row. Found the experience to be... So, you know, they're kind of talking about the same stuff.
Yeah.
Although one is a little bit more, maybe I'm a little more comfortable with one as opposed to the other.
White Noise is a bigger over the top fear. And Bardo's like the everyday fear. Would you agree?
You don't think death is an everyday fear?
I don't know.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. White Noise is the big death fear, and Bardo's just the heart attack kind of fear.
Is one death more deathy than the other?
Yeah, toxic airborne event, getting shot with a gun, all those. Yeah, those are big. That's like the big one.
Like the dramatic kind of
death. Mm-hmm, the dramatic.
Would you rather perish in a toxic airborne event or just your heart, your ticker gave out?
Ticker gives out.
But it could just happen at any moment.
Toxic airborne event sounds like my skin might melt and it would be really bad or something.
There was painful. A really shitty band in the mid-2000s called the Airborne Toxic.
I can't believe we made it almost a half hour before that got brought up. That was impressive.
They were terrible, right? Yeah. Absolutely terrible.
Like Adam Morrow here, I was shocked to see Dean Wareheim just sitting around in the camp.
Him and Britta.
Playing guitar.
Dean and Britta got caught up in the event.
How about that? It blew my mind.
I raised my arms, my hands above my head, and just started like fist pumping in the air. I was so excited to see them.
I sat straight up. Are they friends with Noah Baumbach or something?
I guess so. You know, they're in LA now, so they must be running in the same circles, and I don't know. Seeing them, I was like, you know, I haven't really enjoyed this movie so far, but if they agreed to be in it, maybe I should reconsider.
I think we pointed out what I think everyone would not like or like, but I will ask this. You know, when you adapt a book, you can do a few things with it, assuming the author is not one of the executive producers or anything. Would setting it in 2023 make it better and less abstract? Or would that even be more on the nose?
I don't know that it would.
I don't know how much of a difference it makes.
It's looking at like a certain shiny nostalgic point in our collective memory, even though I wasn't alive for the 80s. Mm-hmm. You were. Adam was. But it's like when we think back, we think of things like Thor Ragnarok, which has that like 80s sheen to it, Stranger Things, which has that 80s sheen to it. And I think that it's kind of picking at and undermining the artificiality of that lifestyle and that mm-hmm. life.
And DeLillo wrote it or had it published in 85, mm-hmm. the time that it's set. That's why I wondered if fast-forwarding it to our time changes anything.
That's a good question.
I think it aids it a lot, Donovan, like you're saying, that there are moments that feel like a classic Spielberg.
That's a really good point. Yeah.
Like the moment where they're all at dinner and have to bail out to escape the toxic fumes, like that just kind of has that classic 80s and then 90s too, some family thriller.
That's a really good point. I hadn't even thought of that. But I think Noah Baumbach's a smart guy, so I'm going to assume that he's doing things deliberately. I wonder if he did think of Spielberg's movies at all as he was making this.
I would not doubt that he did.
Well, and I don't know the question of could you have done it and set it in modern day. Like, I don't know that, is there a vibe that you can call back to between the 80s and now that's so kind of universally just like a warm and fuzzy feeling? I kind of don't think so, right?
Maybe the 90s for a second, but that would be it.
But you can look so quickly at a a Stranger Things kind of vibe, and everybody recognizes immediately what's comfortable and warm and cozy about that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how you use the visual cues and the music and all that kind of stuff to create that in the same way for the 90s. I don't know.
Yeah.
Especially when you're talking about, like, suburban family life.
I'm still stuck over here thinking about you comparing it to Spielberg, because I think that that's...
just at moments, not the whole thing.
I think there's something really... Yeah, yeah, not the whole thing, but I think there's really something
there. No, I think
that
might be the entry point, right, to some viewers?
Yeah.
This is Spielberg via Baumbach, Lynch
lens. You know, when you linger on the movies on Netflix, as you're flipping through and they play the little trailer... What plays is them bailing out of the house during dinner. You know, it's kind of advertised as that second act is kind of at the forefront. And it does have that very throwback family adventure kind of thing.
Yeah, I think I really agree with you there. I wouldn't have thought of it if you hadn't said it, but I think I really agree with that.
Well, that's what we think of White Noise. It's on Netflix. We're going to take a break after... The break, we'll talk about another Netflix movie, Bardo. All right, we're going to talk about Bardo. Before we do, I think I was the only one that watched The Last of Us. We might talk about that with more episodes aired, because I'm thumbs up on it.
I think I'm going to watch it.
Yeah, it seems like... It's really interesting to watch it after having seen so much like it. Like, what in the hell could they do differently or better? But let's get into the other Netflix movie, which is Bardo, subtitled. It's got a colon. Bardo, False Chronicle of a Handful of Truths, directed by Alejandro Iñárritu. Anyway, he also directed Babel. Birdman won an Oscar for Birdman with his directing skills, and 21 Grams, which I've seen 21 Grams and Birdman, and loved Birdman a lot.
Birdman was fantastic.
It's so good. It's one of my favorite movies.
Wow.
Like, period.
That's high praise, yeah.
Yeah, I would say it's in the top 10 of my. It was so good. And you know what? He's messing around with some similar themes, I think, with this one. I think they have some... You can tell it's the same director. That's for sure. The camera movement really feels of the same piece.
I was thinking that, like there's bits where that in Birdman, there's that long shot where he walks down the hallway in his underwear. Yeah. And there were some camera movements that really felt like, oh, okay, this is the same guy.
The camera feels like a head on a swivel. Yeah, it's good stuff. So Bardo is I think it was technically released in 2022, but just... recently came onto Netflix, maybe at the very end of December, if not the 1st of January. We're on it, though. We've got it. We are going to spoil it. And again, plenty to spoil, really. A lot to spoil. But the overview, it is a Mexican, kind of a Mexican epic movie of this documentary director and his recent praise and how that's affecting him and his relationships between wife and friends and kids. That doesn't sound like much. So if you haven't seen it, know that there's more than that. You can watch it, but we're going to spoil it. Okay. And we're just going to start spoiling right now if you want, but
we're going to spoil the hell out of it right now.
I would say this one, if you haven't watched it, you should go in blind.
Yeah. I went in pretty, very blind, quite blind. Just the title was all I knew. Boy, oh boy! I don't want to hog the floor, but I wish you guys could have seen my thought process or read my thought process as I watched this one, because I went from very accepting because of the director, very very giving it a lot of room mentally, and then about midway through, I got a little frustrated. And then about 3/4 of the way through, I was like, no, this thing's just, it's got too many ideas. It's too many ideas. It needs to pick two and run with it. And then at the end, when I saw what it was really about, I was like, oh, I love this. No, it needed all those ideas. That's what it's about.
You really scared me there. I just went on an emotional ride with you. I was like, oh, no.
No,
I went. Blaine's about to not like this movie that I adored.
I thought, man, is Bardo supposed to be a Mexican Robert Altman film gone wrong? I was like, what the hell is going on? But at the end, and we're spoiling it, I guess I could say so, but at the end when you realize, no, it's about his life and how he might be viewing it or trying to figure it out or where he stood in it, I was like, oh, well, then that's brilliant. The movie demands your patience, but it also rewards it because it's pretty long.
It's a little too long,
but it was still.
It's about, what, 2 hours, 40 minutes?
Yeah, it was pretty long. And that's, I think, what got me. When I was about halfway through, I still had an hour and 20 minutes. That was the very loose outline of what I went through mentally. But
well, I'm going to fire a broadside. I found it interminable.
No.
Huh. I considered turning it off. I watched the whole thing.
No, I did too. When I got to that point, I was like, man, this is a Robert Altman film, but bad. I was like, let me ask you this. Was it during the party scene where he was being celebrated by all his friends? Was that when you thought about turning it off?
No, it was just as the movie went on. I found it reminded me, this is going to be a really weird comparison, but it reminded me of another film that I can't watch, which is Richard Linklater's Slacker, where he just follows, he just jumps from one person to the other, to the other, to the other, and there's not much of a story there. And, I mean, at the end of it, looking back on it, it's like, okay, I get it. Mm-hmm. But, as a movie and as a bunch of pieces put together, it just didn't work for me.
That's funny because right before it got to figuring it out, and I should have, I'm an idiot for not, I'll just let a movie take me where it wants to take me. I don't sit there and try to play guessing games with it. But about 3/4 of the way through this, I thought, you know, Netflix gives you that option of thumbs down, thumbs up, and then two thumbs up. Yes. And I was like, man, I'm not going to give it a thumbs down because I don't want Netflix to be encouraged to make schlock. But I'm also not going to give it the two thumbs up because I don't think I love this. So I was like, I'm just going to hit like. Well, I ended up on two thumbs because of what I said earlier. The ending. It does a full circle and it rewards my patience. And then I figured out why it was using what it was using. You know, it's the juxtaposition of two things, life, death, America, Mexico. You know, pick another two that you saw in there. Father, son, success, unhappiness. You know, and I loved it. But I don't know that I loved watching it.
I will say my feeling watching it and at the end of it was kind of like, if you're going to fail, go fail by going broke. Mm-hmm. Swing for the fences. And I don't know if this movie is a failure or not. It just didn't work for me. But I also appreciated that it wasn't failing because it was playing safe. It was whatever else you can say about it. It will probably be unlike anything else that I see this year.
Now, Adam, despite Dean Wareham not being in this movie, Adam loved it.
I love this movie. So, yeah, I thought it was fantastic. I agree that it was long. And there was a moment in the party scene. It's funny that you mentioned that specifically.
When it felt long to me.
Yeah, and I got up to run to the bathroom and get a little LaCroix, settle back down. And when I pressed play again, I was like, man, this is how I wasn't even quite to halfway. It was right when he's about to talk to his old friend, who kind of dresses him down. That happened. And then it accelerated enough from there that I kind of forgot my time frustration. This is one that I know I use this metric a lot, but not only could I not look at my phone because of the subtitles, but I was like transfixed, both from the story and from what I found to be really beautiful cinematography and
fantastic
scene setting, not just the way they moved the camera, but the whole thing just felt so vibrant and alive.
Yes.
And I really enjoyed getting a perspective. You know, this is like one of the beautiful things of art is, obviously, I can never understand what it would feel like to be a Mexican journalist documentarian who succeeds and kind of is forced to leave home in some ways, but still is very much in love with that place. despite following his career and the convention that says go elsewhere. But the movie, I think it's as close as I can get to understanding that love-hate relationship. And it almost felt, you know, this is like something Faulkner does with the South. Like, it's, there's a long history of that vibe and the way that they brought it to a head at the immigration passport checkpoint late in the film. Yeah. I just thought just that aspect alone was spectacularly done. I thought all the family stuff was great. I found the main guy to be, couldn't take my eyes off of him. Just a magnetic presence on screen.
The actor?
Yeah.
He was good. Yeah, I agree. He was very good.
And I think the use, we went into it and you watch the trailer and it's, what Beatles song did they use? All I remember is classic Beatles song in the trailer.
I almost wonder if I would have liked this more if I had seen each scene as a short film.
I debated that, yes.
Because each scene is, you know, it's not a badly or poorly made movie, if that makes sense.
Not in the least. It's excellent as far as, I mean, it's just great to watch. Go, but Adam, you were saying something. What Beatles song did you figure out?
The trailer has I Am the Walrus playing, and it's this like long cut of these different scenes from the film, and you have stuff, the Mexican-American battle in that compound or whatever's happening, but they're there too. And so you kind of get the sense that, like, how surreal is this movie going to go? And when it starts, and there's that walking and then jumping and flying and then coming back to the ground, which I thought was incredible. That being the bookend was great.
Yeah.
But still, it took me a while to figure out how all these things were linked. And they were linked. To me, the...
Oh, you didn't know?
Well, I mean, to know from the trailer is just like basically a sizzle reel of great cinematography more than like any indication of what the story is going to be. And Donovan, I see what you're saying about the slacker comparison. But to me, he's like making a knot that's very loose. And as the film goes on, just pulling it a little tighter and a little tighter until at the end, it just snaps into place. And for me, it worked. And, you know, I also thought a lot about magical realism and the role that that plays south of the border and everything from Marquez to, there's a fantastic book, Pedro Paramo. Have either of you guys read that?
I don't think so.
So it's written by Juan Rulfo, came out in 1955. And when I was reading, apparently Marquez had it memorized, like adored this book, like whole passages he could just recite from memory. He had copies that were falling apart. And it's about a guy who goes back to his small town again, and there's nothing there except these kind of like, you know, just a few people who are basically ghosts at that point. And spoiler alert here, everyone is dead, including him, by the end, you realize. And it's just like a masterpiece of surrealist magical realism. And it makes complete sense. I haven't seen that book cited anywhere in reviews of Bardo. I mean, in another word, Pedro, the main character, is in the Bardo in that. I see so many parallels between the film and the, maybe in Latin American literature, the acceptance of strangeness, you know, and a spiritual realm and all these things. So that, yeah, if he's in a coma going through all of this, or if it's not that, if it's something like it doesn't matter. Like, the story is still has its weight.
Oh, I was going to say, for that reason, this movie really made me kind of question myself. Because I think what you said, Adam, is very valid. And so it was more like my thought process since that has been, why didn't I get it? Why didn't it work for me?
And those are the kinds of movies and books that I can just absolutely hate. Because when I'm done, I get so pissed that I felt like something was going on that I didn't get.
I feel more perplexed than anything else. Because, like, honestly, the closest I could think of as far as American surrealist filmmaking was, I think I've mentioned him twice now today, was David Lynch.
Yeah.
And there's bits where, like...
Oh, it felt Lynchian.
Yeah. And, like, you know, there's bits, like, in the middle of Twin Peaks Season 3 when we get the whole black and white episode and nothing makes sense. And this movie makes sense a lot more than say, something that David Lynch did. Yet, I was willing to meet that episode in a way that, for whatever reason, I don't think I was willing to meet this movie.
One of the things I still knock it for, if you follow the three of us on Letterboxd, you get a little bit of a spoiler of how I think about something before we talk about it on the show. But because I saw what Adam rated this movie, I think I ended up rating it the same thing, 4 out of 5. So why did it get the 5th star for me, or even a half of another star? The protagonist, Silverio, or something like that.
Silvio?
It's not Silvio. It's not that.
Oh, I thought it was.
There's another. There's another syllable in there.
Oh yeah,
Silverio. But they don't pronounce it. Yeah, forgive us if you are Spanish speaking. We're not. but there were times where, and this is not 100% true, but the movie reeked of a man who's successful but is whining about his success, and sometimes I can't get too on board with that. That was one small knock, but I still liked him okay as a character. I still, you know, was digging him and was like, I still wanted to see what happened to him. And the second thing was, I love movies, books, songs that are focused on one or two things, and then the more you think about it, the more you see it's also semi-focused on 8 other things. This one was the opposite, where it was focused on 10 things, sometimes at once, and it was just too goddamn heavy sometimes. But then at the end, you realize it was reeling in and focusing in on one thing, which was living life, or, well, life v. death, you know. I think what won me over, what kept me in my seat, though, was those scenes and how they were going to tie in the idea of Mateo. I kept coming back to that mentally. And those scenes with Silverio and his dad and mom also planted me firmly in my seat and were quite affecting, emotionally speaking. Yeah. Really, when they shrunk Silverio down to a kid size, but he had his adult face, man, that was so relevant to me and heartbreaking.
Yeah.
It got me. And that was shortly after the party scene, or it's actually at the very end of the party scene. And I was like, oh no, man, I gotta sit for this one.
He also won me over a bit because he enters that scene because he's a man fleeing a party to hide in the bathroom.
How many times?
Yeah. Then he has the out of body surrealist experience of hanging out with his dead dad.
If I had a nickel for every time I fled a party and went to the bathroom to hide from it and talk with a dead relative, I'd be pretty rich.
You'd have at least $6, I bet.
I'd have $6.50.
It's a lot of nickels.
Anyway, it all added up to a piece, and it rewarded my patience. I don't know if I'll ever watch it again. I don't know. But goddamn it, man, that imagery of the shadow running, and the sound design of this movie.
So good.
God, I mean, that alone might have made it, because that sound of his running, the shadow running and then jumping and then running and jumping, it reminded me so much of Toni Morrison's Song of Solomon. Have you ever read?
No, I've actually never read that.
Okay, well, I won't say much more, but okay. Wow.
That's funny that y'all both liked that scene, because it was not like off-putting for me, but it was just watching that bit, and it was like, okay, I get it.
Yeah, yeah. It did last a little bit long, but you know, it's a kind of a Lynchian film with some Malick moments, so that's
definitely some Malick moments.
That's set in the book in the for sure.
That's why this really made me question myself, because I'm like, I can usually watch David Lynch and enjoy him, and even when Terrence Malick is being slow. Like, there are parts of The Thin Red Line where he's being real slow.
Yeah.
But it's always gorgeous. But also, I think part of that is I don't know what it's about. And this one, maybe I did kind of know what they wanted me to be thinking about. I don't know. Maybe that's part of why it just didn't work for me, as opposed to something that I just have to experience and figure out on my own.
Silverio was definitely supposed to be the director.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he even looked like him.
Yeah.
There was I thought, is he playing himself?
I had to look it up.
I was like, wait, is that him? I thought that in the first scene. I thought, yeah, that's the director, because he looks just like that. But no, there's some differences. I think it could have done without trying to preemptively defend itself. They maybe tried to do that here and there.
Tell me more.
That was the note I made, and I do not remember when I thought that. But there's a moment where it's like, I know I'm going to be attacked, or I could be criticized for this particular thing, and I'm going to go ahead and address it here in the film.
Is it the friend on the rooftop of the party telling him that he has the indulgent shots and all that? I mean, he literally is like explaining the movie. Yeah.
Yes. But as it turns out, when you find out that a lot of the stuff that he brings up early in the film actually turn out to be things that happen, it does kind of make a little bit more sense in that.
This movie made me wish that I knew more about Mexican history, too, because it was so interwoven with that. Everything I know, this is a horrible confession, but everything I know about Mexican history I learned from reading The Savage Detectives. It's obviously playing with and interconnected with that in a way that I don't think I appreciated.
I kind of enjoyed it in the same way that it was nice to, again, the beautiful thing about film, about books, whatever, is that you can kind of crawl in somebody else's perspective in a way that's not possible other ways. Mm-hmm. You know, we, in a lot of ways, are that. He meets the American early on, right? To discuss what he's gonna. We're kind of that guy who like is completely ignorant of this rich history that's not that far from us. I mean, even though I don't think any of the three of us would have a superiority complex at all, we still haven't like gotten down off of the one beat into us by our culture to learn more about that. You know, I've basically like cherry picked books like Pedro Páramo off the. off the surface, but I still don't know the true history.
Yeah.
Now, they have that great moment where he asks him to change his speech, and he says he hasn't written it, and then he says, well, you don't have to change it then.
I did think the note, because it was, I think it was supposed to be funny, and most of the movie to me did not feel funny or witty with Amazon buying Baja California. Kind of always happening in the background there.
Yeah.
Which was, it was a good running joke, but also I don't know if it, I know why it was in there. I don't know if it fit.
Here's my question to everyone, which we may can wind it down here. That migrant caravan, when they were filming that in the desert, is that what Trump saw and thought they were coming instead of this movie? Did he mistake a movie set for a migrant caravan?
It's possible.
Even though it's obviously fictionalized, and there's some surreal parts in there, I just think everything about it's so heartbreaking because it's true. Yeah. Like, that was a scene that it was like, if I'd seen that as a little short film.
Well, and that's, it's again, back, it's almost a white noise point of, like, it's hitting you over the head with it, but the confusion that he feels, you know, he is illustrated as a father and a son, an American, a capitalist and a socialist, and he's like all these different contradictory, that's how you let off, Blaine, is that it's these two, a father and a son, or whatever, you know, these two things, and that idea of him being in that moment, but not really of it. Like, there's no stakes for him in the desert that day when he's with that caravan, and he's with the family, and they're talking about Amazon buying Baja, and they're kind of like, good, maybe they'll fix it up, you know. And he can't understand why his daughter would want to move back. It says, why would you leave Boston? Why would you? You're going to have to live in a gated community and, you know, all this stuff. And his son having to leave behind the little reptilian fish, whatever that thing was. And I don't know.
They're amphibians.
Yeah, amphibians. I forgot the name of the actual creature. But
it's an axolotl. Axolotl.
That was sad.
It was sad. And it was, there's a reason they put that near the end of the film. They teased him and then put it in there, and I thought that was all the way that it tied together and then unraveled identity was so good.
That's how I landed on it, exactly like that. It took the ending to make it great for me, and I don't know if that's a sign of a great movie or a sign of an excellent movie. You know, you can take it either way.
It kind of reminded me of have you ever seen Walk Hard, the Dewey Cox Story?
Of course.
Okay. Adam quotes that movie all the time.
That's a great film. And there's that bit at the beginning where he's like, he has to remember his whole life
Dude, Cox from the beginning to the end. His whole lot before he plays.
Exactly. And I couldn't stop thinking of that as this movie reached its end. Like, this was its Dewey Cox moment.
Well,
he has to process his whole life.
Yeah, and the only, like, trick that I remember is the woman being interviewed on TV early on is talking about him, right? Like, you mm-hmm. don't know it. That's the only, like...
Yeah.
Kind of like...
He hears that in his coma, right? Yeah. On TV.
That's the only kind of, like, blatant Dewey Cox moment. That well-known film device, the Dewey Cox...
The Dewey Cox... Yeah, it's famous. That's it for us, people. Once again, make it a good year. We're still early in the year. Let's make it good. Let us know what we should cover if you'd like. But you can find us on Taking It Down Pod, all one word, on Twitter and Instagram. We have our own social media for those too. But the Alabama Take itself, of course, easily reached through that. We're on almost all social media, Mastodon, Post News, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, just the Alabama Take. You can find it quite easily. Next week, we got some options. I don't know. The Menu, which is now on HBO. Hell Blue Eye is getting some chatter because I just see headlines. That's all I try to stick with until I watch something. The Last of Us, if I can get one or two or three of these people to join me on that trip. I will see, though. We're going to see. Talk to you all next Tuesday about some of that.